From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For over 10 years, Vincent Murano posed as mobsters, drug pushers, and arms dealers. He was a member of the New York City Police Department's Internal Affairs Division, working undercover to catch other police officers who had broken the law. On this edition of Fresh Air, catching cops who are criminals. Also, punk, pop, and rowdy reputations with Paul Westerberg, the lead singer and songwriter of the band The Replacements. Rock historian Ed Ward begins the first of a two-part profile of soul singer and songwriter Curtis Mayfield. And book critic John Leonard reviews Age of Iron, a new novel by South African writer J.M. Coetzee. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher told Parliament today that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein must be made to pay for what she called the terrible crimes he's committed against the people of Kuwait. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from London.
During question time in the House of Commons today, Mrs. Thatcher was asked about reports that a brother-in-law of the Kuwaiti ambassador to Britain had been tortured and then executed in front of his family.
We all share the revulsion of that brutal act, and we've seen the Amnesty International report of many other brutal acts conducted daily by Saddam Hussein in Kuwait, which makes it clear that we really must deal with this man. And I agree with my honorable friend that he must be made answerable for these terrible crimes.
The Prime Minister's comments come a day after President Bush compared Saddam's actions to those of Hitler and raised the prospect that the Iraqi leader would be called before a Nuremberg-style war crimes trial. This is Brian Naylor in London.
French and Lebanese officials today tried to downplay the conflict over France's grant of asylum to rebel Christian leader Michel Aoun. General Aoun took refuge in the French embassy in Beirut on Saturday after a combined force of Syrian and Lebanese troops drove him from his headquarters. The Lebanese government has refused to let Aoun leave the country, saying it's considering trying him for alleged war crimes and theft. Today, the French ambassador said that neither country will permit the disagreement over Aoun to develop into a crisis. Lebanese authorities have set up a checkpoint near the French embassy, saying it's designed to prevent anti-Aoun demonstrators from storming the building. The Israeli government is ignoring American and international pressure and is refusing to accept a UN delegation set up to investigate last week's violence at the Temple Mount. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
In his meetings today with Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy and Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, visiting British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd offered a compromise. Israel would continue to reject the UN Security Council resolution condemning Israel, but would agree to cooperate with the UN investigating team, even on a low level. But Shamir refused the compromise, saying Israel will not cooperate with the delegation as a matter of principle because the UN does not accept Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Jerusalem Mayor Teddy Kollek says he is willing to meet the delegation, an idea the Prime Minister's office rejected. Israel is under great international and American pressure to accept the delegation so that world attention will return to the Gulf crisis. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A two-day rally came to an end on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 35 points to close at 2,381.19. Declines led advances by a margin of 5-2 in active trading. Volume on the New York Exchange was 151 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You can think of my guest as a character actor in a crime role, but the crimes around him were real, and so were the criminals. Vincent Murano was an undercover cop in the New York City Police Internal Affairs Division. From 1976 to 86, it was his job to investigate police officers suspected of armed robbery, drug trafficking, blackmail, arson, and murder. Murano often posed as mobsters and hitmen. He's written a book about his undercover work called Cop Hunter. Murano became a cop in 1965. He got involved in investigating police corruption through Bob Lucy, the cop whose story was told in the film Prince of the City. After Lucy exposed corruption on the force, he needed protection. Murano was his bodyguard. It was then that Murano saw firsthand how a cop who testifies against another cop is despised. I asked Vincent Murano if cops hate him now because he served in internal affairs.
Probably most of them. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, too. It just bothered the hell out of me. You know, why I constantly had to make excuses, you know, and my wife had to make excuses. You know, what does your husband do for a living, or what did he do? Well, he worked in the police department. Oh, that's very nice. What a nice job. Where did he work? He worked in the Internal Affairs Division. Oh, how awful. Oh, my God, that's terrible. He locked up his brother offices. See, these are the kind of remarks that I would get or my wife would get. And that's bull, because I locked up criminals that happened to be policemen. And, you know, policemen should know about the type of work that I did. My family should be proud of what I did. No policeman wants to be riding in a police car next to someone who hired me to kill somebody. And that policeman who says that he doesn't care, there's something wrong with him. I mean, that's the way I feel.
So what were the typical crimes that you'd go after?
Well, I really, it's one of the problems with the Internal Affairs Division, and I say that in the book, because there's so many types of corruption, you know, from everything from a sandwich for free, or for we call shoppers who look for bargains, to cops, you know, who hired me to murder someone. That's all investigated in the Internal Affairs Division. And, you know, I worked on very serious cases where I was arresting criminals that happened to be policemen. Types of cases were cases like the Coleman case, which I was very proud of that case. And I wanted other policemen to know about this case. Coleman was a police officer, and he worked with another police officer named Ron Law. That's the irony of that. His name was Law, L-A-W. And they actually sold me, and I was posing as an organized crime hitman and a criminal. They sold me police uniforms. They sold me guns. They sold me badges. They sold me complete disguise so that I could pose as a policeman to enter into a closed jewelry store to do a robbery. They also sold me a radio so that I could monitor where the police were, and I could actually call in and send the police to another part of the precinct to call in a fake, what we call a 1013, which would be a CIS patrolman. These two fellas would do anything for money. They were just two bad guys, and these are the type of people that can infiltrate the police department. These were criminals before they were cops. They were criminals while they were cops, and they're criminals today, I'm sure.
My guest is Vincent Murano, and he's the author of the new book, Cop Hunter, which is about his years with New York's Internal Affairs Division investigating corrupt cops. Now, you often went undercover. That was really your specialty. Mm-hmm. Had that been done much before in Internal Affairs?
Well, I'm sure that the Internal Affairs Division did have some undercover type things, but not so direct. What I mean by that is, you know, what they considered undercover would be if you were in a bar having a beer, you would be watching something. You would be observing something in the bar go down or a deal take place. To me, that's not undercover. What I did was undercover. What I did was I played many different characters, everyone from a street wino, a bum druggie, to a high-level capo in a crime family. So I hit everything in between, a smuggler, a hitman, many different characters I played, and I actually infiltrated the criminals. I became one of them. And that's how, what I consider undercover. That's really undercover. When you live that life, I lived in an apartment in Mineola and away from my home for a number of months. I always had to make sure I had a car that didn't have license plates that could be traced. I had a phony ID. My name is Vincent Murano. Vincent Murano never existed after 1976 when I went to Internal Affairs Division. My name became Vincent Muccio. Everyone called me Vinnie Moo. That was a criminal record established in the Criminal Records Division. I had a record. I had fingerprints on file. I was a criminal.
Now, when you were undercover, you used something called the Hello Phone, which I've seen on TV and in movies, but I wasn't sure if real people undercover actually used it. Do you want to describe how the Hello Phone works?
Yeah, it's used quite a bit in undercover situations. A Hello Phone is a supposedly untraceable phone that the phone company hooks up for us, where It might be if you had a connection with the phone company, say, and you said, "Where is this phone listed to?" And it would be a phony address somewhere in maybe Brooklyn or New York or Manhattan. But in fact, the phone was on my desk at the Internal Affairs Division. And I would anyone who picked up that phone says hello. They don't say, "Hello, this is the Internal Affairs Division," because that's the number I would give out as my phone for any of these criminals to contact me. And that's a hello phone. And it's very simple. It's you say hello when you pick it up. That's it.
So it's like an undercover phone.
Right, exactly, yeah. And that was usually set up, that phone, with a tape recorder attached. Technically it's called an induction coil, but you've seen them. What it really is just a piece that goes over the earphone, and it plugs into the microphone of a tape recorder. And it's hooked into a tape recorder, and whenever the phone rings, you'd hit the button and you'd record. And that's what you do, and that's what that phone was always set up for, just undercover work.
You were also wired a lot. You had a tape recorder on your body often to record the incriminating discussion. Where would you conceal it?
Well, it depends. But most people hesitate to search, even policemen, and to put their hand in your private parts, your genital area. So whenever I felt uncomfortable or I thought I would be searched, I wanted to wear a tape recorder 99% of the time, because it's very important to get that type of evidence when you're working on police corruption. So I would hide the tape recorder, I would tape it to my thigh, or I would tape it in my back sometimes. Sometimes you had to use two types of equipment. There is something called a transmitter, which is usually very small, much smaller than a pack of cigarettes. I could conceal it much better. And the other reason why you would wear a transmitter is so that people, my backup in the area, would be able to monitor and hear if I was in trouble. They might not be able to save me in time, you know, because they have to get into this place, but at least they'll be knowing when I'm getting bumped off or whatever.
Did you ever position yourself into unusual angle so that the microphone would be pointed in the right direction and you'd be sure to get good sound?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I tell you, sure, you got better as you went along. You know, most of the tapes that I made, I transcribed. And, you know, I got to know by experience how to set myself up in a position to make a good recording, because I'm the one that had to make the transcription. And let me tell you, sometimes a 20-minute conversation, depending on the background noises, if there's a jukebox or dishes clanging, you'll spend 3 weeks transcribing that tape. You know, because, you know, a U.S. attorney or a prosecutor, they don't want you to too many unintelligibles on a transcript. They don't want to see inaudibles. They want that thing transcribed. So, you know, I learned to get, you know, good recordings. I learned if there was a jukebox, like in one case, on the Coleman case, we were sitting next to a jukebox, and all my backup, and I had backup this particular evening, were inside of an Italian restaurant. I made a decision to leave the restaurant. I couldn't tell my backup this. I mean, I just made a decision that I had to take a chance, so I went outside under an awning, and we got a good recording, but I didn't have any backup, but I took that chance. A car is always very good. You know, and, you know, if you're sitting in a car and I have the tape recorder and the microphone, say, underneath my right armpit or my right shoulder, I could put my arm on the seat and face the person I'm speaking to, and he'll be maybe 10 inches right from the microphone. I mean, I used to be able to get great recordings that way.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Vincent Murano, and his new book, Cop Hunter, tells of the years he served in the Internal Affairs Division of the New York City Police Department, investigating corruption and crime on the force. He retired in 1986. This is Fresh Air. Vincent Marano is my guest, and his new book, Cop Hunter, is about his years in the Internal Affairs Division on the New York City Police Force. Now, you say that when you started in the Internal Affairs Division that they really liked to play it by the book. Were there things you wanted to do that weren't by the book?
Yes, I feel that you really had to improvise to a great extent to make the types of cases I made. When you're going after policemen, you really have to use different techniques. I mean, it's very difficult to follow and do surveillance on a policeman who's familiar with that type of techniques.
What's an example of something that you did that wasn't by the book?
Well, one particular case, I was working on two cases, actually, at the same time. Both of them were, I was playing an organized crime type of person. In one case, I was Vinnie Moo, and in one case, I was Vinnie Cab. I always used my own first name in case I ran into a neighbor or someone, which happened to me. What I did was I actually had, on these two separate investigations, on two separate targets, I had them meet each other in a restaurant with me present. That's something that really isn't, that kind of thing is dangerous because if you blow the case, you could blow two cases. But I actually thought it would work, and it actually did work, and it did help one gangster convince the other gangster that I was a gangster. So I used them against each other.
You used sting sometimes, too.
Yes.
Was that accepted by IAD?
Well, actually, it was. What you call the sting is something that really is technically and legally right to do. Courts have upheld what you mean by a sting as a setup, get someone involved in a robbery. And see that the key word here is the word of entrapment. If I go to a police officer and say to him, "Do you want to do a robbery with me tonight?" and he says, "Oh, great, let's do it." I mean, or if I say to a police officer, "This is a very easy robbery to do. We're going to go to this place. No one's going to be there. I have the key." Now, this police officer, what he's supposed to do is report this. So how can you entrap a police officer? He's bound by his oath to report this. So it's very difficult for a policeman to prove entrapment.
How would you know which cops were corrupt? Would you have informants who would tell you who was corrupted? Did you go into a case knowing that something was fishy with somebody?
Well, it depends. There are many different types of investigations. But I could tell you right now, I feel very strong about this. The only way to make a really important case is with an informant or a turnaround or someone that's caught, and we use different words, flipped or turned, to tell on other people. I mean, it sounds, maybe it doesn't sound very nice, but that's the name of the business we're in. I mean, we're not here, having a Sunday dinner. I mean, we're here to arrest people that commit crimes. What happens is, in most cases, one case leads to another case. And, and it's a chain reaction.
An important part in making a case is the part that happens in court after the bust is made. How can you possibly testify in court and then go back on the street as an undercover agent?
Happens all the time.
I mean, I just find it so hard to believe that pictures of you don't circulate all around the underworld.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, what can I say? It's a big city, and was it 8 or 9 million people? I worked undercover for 15 years, and I never got my cover was never blown. I've testified hundreds and hundreds of hours in trials, and that night I'd be out playing the part of Vinnie Moo, the hitman. I mean, it's incredible, but it's a big city, and I've done it. I did it for 15 years, and I never got one time actually. When I was working on a case involving the Laurel brothers, I was in a diner, and we were discussing committing a robbery and a burglary. And a neighbor walked in who happened to be a coach on a Little League team that I was on with my son. And he come over to the table and he started talking to me about this and that and how you doing, Vinny. And It was a very scary moment, but I convinced this neighbor of mine to leave, and when I got him alone in the bathroom, I said to him, look, go away. You don't know what I'm doing here. I couldn't go into too many details, but here's this heavy-duty criminal sitting there discussing a robbery, and here's my neighbor coming over to talk about Little League.
There have been a couple of contracts on your life, right, after you've
Yes.
busted people. Now, after one bust, to avoid there being a contract on your life, you said to the guy, look, I'm not an informant or a lieutenant turned informant. I'm from internal affairs. Business is business. You were caught. It wasn't anything personal. Why did you think that telling him that it wasn't anything personal was significant enough to, like, deter him putting a contract out on your life?
Well, the main thing, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about a person, one of my last cases. His name was Nunzio Di Carlo. He was a made man, which means he had to do something to be accepted into organized crime, which could mean he killed someone. Basically, that's what that means. He was a made man. He was a guy that I was dealing with. This is a very unusual role I was playing. Actually, the only time I ever really did this, I was playing the part of a corrupt lieutenant in charge of the narcotics division. And this Nunzio Di Carlo was a soldier, I believe, which is a connected guy involved with the Gregory Scarpa crime family. And he was selling drugs. And he was bribing me. I was playing the part of a corrupt lieutenant who was protecting his drug operation. And when he eventually was arrested, I wanted it to be made very clear to him that I was not a corrupt lieutenant that got caught doing something wrong and then turned and became an informant and ratted on him. Because the rules change at that point. If you're an informant and you tell and have someone arrested, they feel that that's legitimate time to whack you, to kill you, to murder you. There's no problem with killing me then. But if I'm a police officer and I'm doing my job and they get caught, this is an unwritten law, and I believe it's true, that there will be no contract out on me in that particular instant. That's why I told him who I really was.
Vincent Murano is my guest, and his new book, Cop Hunter, is about his years investigating corruption and crime on the New York City police force. He served in the Internal Affairs Division and retired in 1986. Did you feel that the brass in the police department tried to prevent certain crimes from being uncovered because it would make the department look bad?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I'm critical of the Internal Affairs Division, and I think in a fair way. But, you know, there was no cover-up for the sake of a cover-up. There was some incompetence. There was some maybe not caring attitude. And there was some concern over publicity, that's for sure. You know, you got to remember that even though it's internal affairs, it's still part of the police department. And they all answer to the same police commissioner. So when 12 cops get indicted, heads are going to roll. I mean, there's no question about it. So they sort of protect their own.
You know, listening to you talk about your work undercover, I can't help but think that there was some enjoyment you had hanging out with the mobsters and dressing and talking like one yourself. I'm not to make light of how dangerous it was and how important the job was, but
what do you ask me? Did I like what I? Sure, I liked what I did. I liked it. I enjoyed the action. I enjoyed the danger. Right? Not all the time. I mean, you know, there were times when I was concerned and worried about my family. When the contract was put out on me, it was a very difficult time for me. I had children that I was worried about. I was worried about, you know, these bombs that could put on your muffler in your car. It takes 2 seconds to hook it up.
These were some criminals who put a contract out on your life.
Sure. I mean, yeah. So there were difficult times. But, you know, out in what they called on the set is the word they use. I loved it.
So what have you been doing since you retired?
Well, I was a salesman for a short while I was writing the book. Now that the book is finished, I actually... I'm very fortunate. I'm going to be writing a second book, which should be hopefully done in a couple of years, a novel, actually. It's about some character I invented. I think it's very interesting, and we'll see what happens. I am retired under what they call the Hart Bill, which means, you know, I had two heart attacks, so the pension is something you could live with. I mean, it's a decent pension. It's three quarters of my last year's pay, and it's also tax free. So, you know, it's, you know, I could survive. I'm not a big spender, and I'm not a gambler or a big drinker or a carouser about town. I'm a homebody type person, really. I enjoy putting along in my grass and shrubs and play a little golf, and that's all, really. And writing books now. I guess that's what I'm going to be doing, hopefully.
When you were working with IAD and you had to convince someone that you really were a cop, mm-hmm. that this criminal stuff was just an undercover disguise, would you have any way of doing it? I mean, you're not carrying a badge with you when you're undercover.
Well, I would make sure. See, most policemen that we arrested were either at the special prosecutor's office or in the Internal Affairs Division. Now, if I arrested someone, if I knew the arrest was going to happen, and usually you do in these kind of cases, it's not the type of a thing where you or someone comes running out of a bank with a gun and you rob them, you know, arrest them. These things are indictments; they're planned. And you know, when the arrest goes down, most of the time I am there, and I do have my shield, and I do make sure that they know who I am. I am Detective Vincent Morano from the Internal Affairs Division. You're under arrest, or if a lieutenant made the arrest, or someone else made the arrest, I'll make sure I was there. If I could, you know, I'd make sure this is who I am. You were arrested for this, this, and this, and I am a detective. I work undercover, and you're in, buddy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Nice meeting you.
Vincent Murano writes about his years in the Internal Affairs Division of the New York City Police Department in the book Cop Hunter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And I have a preview of a concert coming up on Friday. We'll present British singer June Tabor, accompanied by pianist Hugh Warren. This song from her album Aquaba will give you a sense of how she sounds.
In the West End of Derby lives a working man. He says, I can't fly, but my pigeons can. And when I set them free, it's just like part of me gets lifted up on shining wings. Charlie Hudson's pigeon loft was down the yard of a rented house in Brook Street where life was hard. But Charlie had a dream, and in 1913 Charlie bred a pigeon that made his dreams come true. There was gonna be a champions race from Italy. We got out the maps, all that land and sea. Charlie, you'll lose that bird, but Charlie never heard. He put it in a basket and sent it off to Rome. On the day of the big race, a storm blew in. 1,000 birds were swept away and never seen again. Charlie, we told you so, surely by now you know. When you're living in the West End, there ain't many dreams come true. Yeah, I know, but I had to try. A man can crawl around or he can learn to fly. And if you live round here, the ground seems awful near. Sometimes I need a lift from victory. I was off with my mates for a pint or two when I saw a wing flash up in the blue. Charlie, it's the King of Rome. Come back to his West End home. Come outside quick, he's perched up on your roof.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with Paul Westerberg, lead singer and songwriter of The Replacements, a post-punk band that discovered melody. Soul star Curtis Mayfield was beginning a comeback when he broke his neck in a freak stage accident over the summer. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward begins a two-part profile of Mayfield, focusing on his early work with the Roosters and the Impressions. And we have a review of Age of Iron, J.M. Coetzee's new novel about South Africa, that critic John Leonard says spares no one. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Secretary of State James Baker today rejected hints from Iraq of compromise, saying only total withdrawal from Kuwait will satisfy the Bush administration. During a State Department news conference, Baker said the U.S. will not accept a partial solution to the Gulf crisis. Barry Schwide reports from the State Department.
Soon after Iraq invaded Kuwait and the U.N. responded with a trade embargo, Baghdad floated hints it is willing to cut a deal. And the latest was a Soviet report that Iraq would withdraw its troops in exchange for some strategic islands. Baker said the U.S. very much wants a political settlement, but he said there is no acceptable alternative to an Iraqi withdrawal, and that Saddam Hussein should not be enabled to claim benefits from the invasion. Baker also came close to accusing Israel of reneging on a pledge not to encourage Soviet Jews to settle in East Jerusalem. Baker cited Israeli assurances against encouraging settlement beyond Israel's pre-1967 Mideast War borders, and he said East Jerusalem, where more Soviet Jews will be housed, was beyond that border. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Budget pressures are building again in Washington. This evening, Republican leaders telephoned President Bush on the campaign trail, advising him that all the talks would come to a head in a day or two. Bush spokesperson Marlon Fitzwater said after the call, the president canceled plans to attend the World Series tomorrow night in Cincinnati to return to the Capitol. House Democrats appear close to passing a deficit reduction plan that would increase taxes on wealthier Americans. Bush said today he'd veto the proposal. The president and House Republicans appear to prefer a Senate plan that would raise money with higher taxes on gasoline, alcohol, and tobacco. The Senate version does not raise taxes on the rich. Months after debate began on reforming his stagnant economy, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has a draft plan to sweep away government controls and set up a free market economic system. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev's proposal would privatize much of the state's huge property holdings. It would grant the 15 Soviet republics more authority over their economies, and it would end many government controls on prices. But Gorbachev set only vague timetables for achieving these sweeping changes, and that is likely to anger many liberal economists and politicians who favored a plan to set up a free market system within 500 days. Gorbachev's much-delayed plan was finally circulated today to members of the Supreme Soviet, the National Legislature. Legislative committees will debate it for the next 2 days before Gorbachev makes a formal presentation to the full Supreme Soviet on Friday. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell to 2381.119.
This is Fresh Air. Soul singer Curtis Mayfield is probably best known for the soundtrack he wrote for the 1972 movie Superfly. This year he was beginning a comeback in this country, but over the summer during a performance, some stage lights fell on him and left him paralyzed from the neck down. With Mayfield unable to perform, rock and roll historian Ed Ward reminds us of his many contributions in the first of a two-part Mayfield tribute.
As with so many tales of people singing together, Curtis Mayfield's career started in church in Chicago. Young Curtis and his best friend, Jerry Butler, were so good that they traveled with the Northern Jubilee Singers and other gospel outfits before they were out of high school. Afterwards, each had his own group, but when Curtis's parents moved to Chicago's North Side in 1957, Jerry talked him into joining his group, the Roosters. Their big break came at a fashion show when one of the women there, Vi Muzinski, was so impressed that she called her friend Calvin Carter, who owned VJ Records. There was this kid with this big voice, she told him, and he had this song.
Your precious love means more to me than any love could ever be. For when I wanted you, I was so lonely and so blue. For that, what love will do. And darling, I...
For Your Precious Love by Jerry Butler and the Impressions, as the label said, was an extremely important record. Although the Impressions were a vocal group, and you can hear them singing backup, the form of the song, as well as Butler's vocal, is very much ahead of its time. It was one of the first soul songs, and the slow dance summer song of 1958. It also spelled disaster for the Impressions. After the group's two follow-ups failed to hit it all, VJ signed Jerry Butler as a solo artist. The group poked along, but it was to Curtis Mayfield that VJ turned when they needed a hit for Butler. Did they get Mayfield's songwriting skills, but that's him duetting with Jerry and, I think, playing guitar. Meanwhile, Curtis and the Impressions knew that they didn't stand a chance of success if they stayed around Chicago and let VJ take Curtis's best work. The group relocated to New York, where Curtis got them a deal with ABC Paramount Records, where their very first record showed off what Curtis could do for them.
From nowhere, through a caravan, around campfire light, a lovely woman in motion, with hair as dark as night. Her eyes were like that of a cat in the dark, that hypnotized me with love.
She was a gypsy woman. She was a gypsy woman.
Gypsy Woman, once again, sounded like nothing else on the radio. In fact, in 1961, its only competition came from VJ, where Jerry Butler's last session with Curtis Mayfield had produced this.
I'm a telling you, oh, I'm a telling you, I'm a telling you, oh, I'm a telling you, I go to work. I try real hard to do my job, but before the day is gone, I find out I've done something wrong. I'm a-telling you, oh, I'm a-telling you, I'm a-telling you, oh, I'm a-telling you, days will get longer and my nights will get shorter.
Curtis wasn't happy with the sound the New Yorkers were giving the Impressions records, and in 1963, he decided to take the group back to Chicago. Two of the members wanted to stay in New York, so the group that returned home was a trio. It proved to be a good move, though, because for one thing, Curtis met an arranger, Johnny Pate, who was to play a major role in his career. The first thing Pate did was to take a rather ordinary gospel-flavored song Curtis had written and turn it into the Impressions' biggest-selling record ever.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right. Have a good time, 'cause it's all right. Whoa, it's all right. We're gonna move it slow. When lights are low, when you move it slow, it sounds like a moan, and it's all right. Whoa, it's all right. Now listen to the beat. Kind of pat your feet.
it's all right. Whoa.
You've got soul, and everybody knows that it's all right, said the song, thereby introducing a phrase to millions of white listeners. The Impressions had soul, all right, and so did Curtis Mayfield and Johnny Pate. Columbia Records knew this, so they hired Curtis Mayfield as their chief producer in 1963 when they revived their OK Records line to go head-to-head with Berry Gordy's Motown operation in Detroit. A lot of great records came out of OK, and I'll get to them next time as we look at the later career of Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
I want to talk about my baby.
Yeah, yeah.
With her pretty smile.
Yeah, yeah.
She's about to drive me crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Makes my heart beat wild.
This is Fresh Air. The Replacements is a band that got together in 1979. They started out as a raucous, high-energy band during the last days of punk. They've managed to stay together in spite of the fact that the band's never broken through to big commercial success. My guest is Paul Westerberg, the lead singer and songwriter of the group. Rock critic Robert Christgau said, "No songwriter in memory matches Paul Westerberg's artful artlessness, the impression he creates of plumbing his heart as he goes along." Westerberg delivers the goods, grimy, uplifting in the tradition, and shocking like new. The Replacements have a new album, All Shook Down. It has a more acoustic sound than their previous records. This is Westerberg's song, Attitude. The Replacements are one of the post-punk bands that's really had longevity. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got together in 79 and you're still together. What do you think has kept the band together that long when so many of the bands who started didn't stay together?
That is a good question, and I can't see that we could have kept the intensity level that we started at. And we haven't. And I think that's, you know, one reason we've stayed together is we've made a record like this. There's no way in the world we could have made those first two albums over and over again for 11 years because that was very manic-styled music, and it was just the whole lifestyle went along with it. And so if we ever get accused for mellowing out or whatever, it's just out of necessity. You grow and you change, and we've changed. I think that's the reason we've stayed together.
Let me get something in here from your first record so listeners can hear what you're talking about. This is from your album, Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash.
Yeah! The irresponsibility, my closest friend, and then my duty, obligation. Tell me about the city, ordinance. Tell me that we're insubordinate. Plan tomorrow, money tomorrow. Careless, careless, good careless.
You've said that it was Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols who made you think that you could sing.
Yes, or made me realize that I can't sing and it doesn't matter.
So what effect did that have on you? Had you wanted to sing before and thought, but I'm just not good enough?
Exactly. I had always wanted to, front a band. And I had spent years playing guitar with groups. But all the time I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to hog the limelight and be in front, and I guess it wasn't until I started writing my own songs that I started to sing, because I couldn't sing other people's songs because my range was so limited, and, you know, I'd never taken lessons or anything, and somehow I'd managed to do it on guitar, but vocally I didn't have the courage until I started writing my own words.
Were there impulses in your own music that you feel you repressed in the early stages of the band to fit in with the punk or post-punk of the period?
Yeah, there was. I mean, we left our calling card as early as the first single, where The Flip Side was an acoustic song with just me alone. But I had always had leanings toward that. From the beginning, I had, let it be known that I like this style of music. I like folk music and country music. But it was tough getting into those clubs, so we had to kind of adapt to what was going on at the time just to be able to go out and play.
What about pop? Did you want to write songs that were more pop at the time and sing songs that were more pop but feel that you couldn't really do it?
I don't think I had the guts to, but that was deep down in my heart, because the music that inspired me most was the trashy throwaway top 40 of the early and mid-70s, because that's what I was weaned on. I think as we progressed, I tried to incorporate that songwriting style into the format of more or less a garage rock and roll band. That maybe was the key to our longevity or success, that we had pop leanings and yet we were basically unschooled and pretty raw.
Well, speaking of pop, I want to ask you about the last track on your new record. This is called The Last. Mm-hmm. And is this you on piano on this?
No, it isn't. I wrote it on piano and I was fine in my living room. But boy, when it comes time to doing it in the studio, my timing is atrocious. And I tried it several times and I just couldn't do it. And Ben Montench from Tom Petty's band was available and more than happy to come in and do it with his feet. He's an incredible musician, so it would have been ridiculous for me to play with him hanging around.
Does it hurt to fall in love so easy? Does it hurt to fall in love so fast? Does it hurt you to find out 30 second hand? Is it such a big task? And such a big task, are you too proud to ask? Remember, last one was your last. It's too early to run to mama. It's too late to run like hell. I guess I will tell you, cause it don't work to ask, that this one be your last. And this one, child, is killing you. And this one's your last chance to make this last one really the last.
So tell me about the song. It seems pretty pop to me. Maybe the closest thing you'll come to a show tune even.
Yeah, I like that, because it does have like a Laura Nero feel, and I wanted it to have that feel, like it could be from a play or something, because some great songs are written in that format.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I like that kind of stuff. It's not your run-of-the-mill thing that rock bands do, but so what?
The Replacements have built a reputation over the years for rowdiness and sloppiness in performance. Do you think that that's justified? I haven't seen the band in concert, I'll confess.
Oh, you never have, huh?
Not in concert, no.
Lies, all lies. We're totally professional.
That's right. You're absolutely technically proficient in concert.
Yeah, that's dangerous, that more people have heard about us than have actually seen us, because in the early years we ran with that, and we would build that legend, and we would let that's why we would never be filmed live. We would let people let the stories get blown out of proportion of what we really were. And I'll say this, that as many times as we were brilliant, we were absolutely atrocious. And we weren't mediocre a whole lot. We were one or the other. And, we were terrible. We've been very sloppy over the years. But we had an attitude that went with it that didn't allow us time to rehearse. You know, it borderlined on theater for a few years, where we would go out there and not even play music. We would go out there and make noise and play cards and change clothes and, read books, do anything to get a reaction from the audience, because at the time things were very serious and we didn't want to be serious.
So you're saying it was intentional when you'd really screw up on stage?
It was in the in the middle period. In the beginning, we were just bad. Then we tried to take that lack of musicianship to a new level and say, oh, well, we meant to do this. And then we were faced with this problem of actually learning how to play, where we kept the looseness but also could play better than we could when we started in 1980. And a lot of people saw that as us breaking away from our old self, when in fact we just we learned a few new chords.
There's been speculation that the Replacements are on the verge of breaking up. Is that true?
In all honesty, yes. But I like it because it keeps things interesting. For us to assume that everything is okay and we're going to continue forever, and it just gets stale and boring. And I saw that happening on tour last year. And I spoke up to the other guys saying that I'd like to make a record on my own. And it just didn't turn out that way. Everyone didn't see it that way, and it was a little difficult. But I like to keep that feeling in their minds that don't see the band as a stable job. Don't see it as a vocation. What you're doing is, you know, is art at its best, and you should not look at it as a job. You do have a responsibility to the people who pay to come see you, but when it gets to be too 9-to-5-y, you just lose the fun in it. And I wanted, you know, if it means throwing a scare into them, that's what I'll do if they're going to just rest on their laurels.
So the Replacements may or may not stay together?
I'd like to say that we're still friends, and yeah, we'll probably tour together, and that's the way I'd like to feel about it. If I met a kid on the street corner that was playing a guitar and it knocked me off my feet, I would bring him to my house and start recording with him tomorrow, if that's what happened. And that's the way I want to look at the future in my life. Like, I want to be inspired by other people, and if those people come along, then I'm not going to stay married to the band just for that reason. I'm going to do what's musically exciting.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Singer and songwriter Paul Westerberg. The Replacements' new album is All Shook Down.
Stop at a light that shines bright blue, and where you've been is still in view. You stopped at nothing at your first chance. Now it's none.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we have news of the House of Representatives considering a plan to reduce the federal deficit, one that would place much of the burden on high-income households, those earning $200,000 and more. Also, news about the president's decline in the public opinion polls and how that's viewed at the White House. And we'll have a report following the progress of 32-year-old Teresa Perez. She's the drug addict whom Patricia Naiman reported on several months ago. She's now 4 months into her treatment at Daytop Center in upstate New York. We'll find out how she's doing.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The white South African novelist J.M. Coetzee has a new book, Age of Iron. His earlier novels include From the Heart of the Country, Waiting for the Barbarians, and The Life and Times of Michael Kay, which won Britain's Booker Prize in 1983. Book critic John Leonard says Coetzee hits hard again.
From J.M. Coetzee, we've come to expect muscular and disquieting allegories, enigmatic parables about power, nightmare landscapes, fractured identity. As if written in code to confound a censor, his earlier novels could have belonged to the underground literature of almost any repressive culture, in Eastern Europe or Latin America. With Age of Iron, however, he confronts South Africa head-on, and they probably wish he'd kept on being enigmatic. The South Africa we visit in these pages is beyond decency or shame, pity or contempt. Not even blacks are spared the writer's savage lash, though they seem to have been forgiven in advance as time runs out on apartheid. Then again, maybe they aren't. Find out for yourself. What we're supposed to be reading is a long letter from Mrs. Curran to her daughter in America. Before she retired, Mrs. Curran taught classics at the university. She refers to Socrates and Aeneas. She writes like Thucydides, lucid, austere, but she disdains the comradeship of warriors, then and now. The Germans had comradeship, she says, and the Japanese, and the Spartans. Comradeship is nothing but a mystique of death, of killing and dying, masquerading as what you call a bond. It is just another of those icy, exclusive, death-driven male constructions. Mrs. Curran is dying of cancer, and so is her country. Cancer is used as a metaphor in Age of Iron in exactly the manner Susan Sontag so deplores. It is said to be the accumulation of shame. Like the Afrikaner government, Mrs. Curran is pregnant with this shame. These cold, obscene swellings. Children inside me eating more every day, not growing but bloating, toothed, clawed, forever cold and ravenous. She accuses her daughter of having abandoned her, but she's really abandoned herself. Any keenness of feeling or capacity to love. If cancer is the white metaphor, iron is the black metaphor. A black boy she doesn't even like is murdered by the police while hiding in her house. As a protest against this murder, and against apartheid, Mrs. Curran considers burning herself alive. I thought I'd burn well, she says. But blacks would not, she thinks. It would be like trying to burn figures of pig iron or lead. They might lose their sharpness of contour, but when the flames subsided, they would still be there, heavy as ever. When I walk upon this land, this South Africa, I have a gathering feeling of walking upon black faces. They are dead, but their spirit has not left them. They lie there heavy and obdurate, waiting to be raised up again. Millions of figures of pig iron floating under the skin of the earth. The age of iron waiting to return. An older black man, an alcoholic vagrant despised by the young militants, moves in with Mrs. Curran. Somehow, out of the smoke and weeping, they achieve, well, a solicitude. I have fallen and he has caught me, she tells her daughter. It is not he who fell under my care when he arrived, nor I who fell under his. We fell under each other, and have tumbled and risen since then in the flights and swoops of that mutual election. Is she the last white liberal? Is he the angel of death? Is this a comradeship immune to icy mystique? Can there ever be forgiveness? I don't know. All I know is that Age of Iron is a baffling book with a terrible beauty, a plague on everybody's house.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Age of Iron by J.M. Coetzee. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet, with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Updike tells us about writing his final Rabbit novel. And some background on a complex scandal. L.J. Davis analyzes the origins of the savings and loan crisis. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.